Blog Talk Radio.
A couple of nights ago, I saw a movie that both fits with the opening music because it was a movie about heroes, but also a movie about that really reflects much of the, you know, politics, the conditions in which we live, the corruption, and the corruption of our country, and particularly with the nomination, the historical nomination of Hillary Clinton to the presidency of the United States. So the movie's called 13 Hours, and it's a movie about Benghazi. It's about what happened in Benghazi on the ground. It's very careful not to make any political statements, not to attribute anything to politicians, although there are hints along the way, and not so much hints, but just the facts that actually happened along the way pretty much condemn Hillary, our politicians, but the entire leadership hierarchy and the military and civilian leadership that we have today, Obama on down. So this is a movie about what happened when the ambassador, I guess, or the special envoy to Libya was murdered by Libyan Islamic totalitarians on September 11th, the September 11th anniversary, and about a group of six individuals, CIA contractors. These were men who were hired to protect the CIA base about 1 mile, 1 kilometer, I think, from where the ambassador was, where I think it was 26 Americans who worked for the CIA in different capacities were holed up. And it describes how these six men went over to try to save the ambassador, landed up saving a couple of other men, Americans, and then engaged in a firefight throughout the night to basically save the 26 CIA operatives on the base with the help of a few other people. But basically these six guys did all the work. And so I'd recommend the movie. It's a very heroic movie. It's a good action movie. It's directed by Michael Bay, whose work is very spotty. But he knows, I guess, how to do action scenes, and it's entertaining, although I find it infuriating. And it brought out a lot of different questions, a lot of questions that have political implications, a lot of questions that have moral implications, a lot of issues that relate to our policy in the Middle East and the policy of the Middle East of both the Bush and the Obama administration, and certainly policy in the Middle East that Hillary Clinton. But it also brought up a lot of issues of rules of engagement, of the morality of war, of what one needs to do in order to protect ourselves during war, and how, in many respects, our country, our political class, our generals, and our population betray the people we send into combat. So I want to start off by discussing 13 Hours and really moving from there to talking about Hillary Clinton, to talk about the Democratic Convention, and discussing a little bit about the election. And then from there, we'll see how many other topics we can cover. I've got a list that covers the Pope and the Pope in Poland right now, and commenting on terrorism and his comment after the priest got his throat slit. It's a good time to do a kind of a Brexit recap. It's a month later, what happened with Brexit. And if there's time, I found a really interesting article about the state of Native Americans and what a solution to the horrific conditions in which Native Americans live today, what a solution, kind of, if you will, a free market solution would be to that. So all of that is on the table. Of course, the Democratic Convention, you know, creates lots of fodder for discussion. But let's start with this movie. So, as I said, six guys. And by the way, you're listening to the Ron Brooks Show, and you can catch the show every week right here. And you can download from iTunes. You can download it from any one of the podcast applications. And you can also follow me on Twitter. You're Ron Brook, YARONBROOK on Twitter. And also on Facebook, same thing. You're Ron Brook on Facebook. Follow me on like me, whatever they call it. All right. So 13 hours, six men, they've got to defend themselves. So let's start with the geopolitical aspect, because this really comes across in the movie. Here we have a big base of CIA operatives. The assumption is that there's a friendly government that is protecting this base, because otherwise they could be easily wiped out. The assumption is that Americans are there to help the Libyans. Of course, the Americans, together with the French and the others, deposed Gaddafi, it bombed the hell out of them, and created the conditions for civil war, massive civil war, in which everybody's fighting everybody. There are gangs everywhere. Nobody knows what their motivations is. And one of the things that comes across very early in the movie is nobody knows who's who. Who are the Americans' friends? Who are the non-Americans' friends? Who are their allies? Who are their enemies? Who should they shoot? Who shouldn't they shoot? Who's who? There's no conception of who's who. There's no conception of why they're there. Why are we there? Really, the ambassador says it best when he says that they're there to make the Libyans' lives better. So is that why Americans should be placed in harm's way, to make the lives of Libyans better, to protect Libya, a crazy country run by a crazy maniac by the name of Gaddafi, and since his fall, completely dominated by civil war? Why is there an ambassador there? Why are there any American personnel on the ground in a civil war where they can't tell who the enemy is and they can't tell who their friends are, where there's no government, where everybody's armed, where there are guns everywhere in the streets, where people are shooting at one another? Why does America have any diplomatic presence there? If the Americans need to go in there and kill a bunch of ISIS people, Al-Qaeda people, fine. Send in special forces, do the job, get out. But why is there a pretense of normalcy? Why is there a pretense that this is somehow good for America to have diplomatic personnel who cannot defend themselves on the ground, so that these six young men have to risk their lives, and two of them actually die, and one other one is significantly injured? Why did they have to die? Why do they have to risk their lives for the sake of what? What is it that we're fighting for? And of course, this is the big geopolitical issue that nobody out there has an answer for. Nobody out there has an answer for. What are we doing there? Why are we there? What's American incentive? Is there an incentive? Is there a purpose? And our political leadership is completely mum on this. And again, I this is a theme that I keep returning to. This is part of why Donald Trump is so successful, because he calls people on that. Now, he doesn't have an answer. He doesn't have anywhere near an answer. And I don't know what he would do in a situation like this, in terms of foreign policy. But at least he's willing to say, we're out there sacrificing to the world. We're not getting anything in return. We're doing stupid things everywhere. And the establishment has no answer to that. And certainly Hillary Clinton, who, if you listen to her speech, her foreign policy is same. Same as Bush. Same as Obama, you know, probably more like Bush than Obama. My guess is Hillary would be less apologetic about America, less, you know, less cowering, less a follower than a leader. So more like Bush, less like Obama. But all of that foreign policy, from Bush to Obama, is corrupt. It's insane. Sacrificial. No goals. No American interest. No articulation of American interest. And again, 13 hours illustrates this really well. What the hell are we doing there? Why the hell do we send Americans into harm's way to achieve what exactly? What is a win? What is success? Establishing a pro-market, freedom-loving, democratic government in Libya. That's success. That's delusional. So a foreign policy run by at best delusion, by at worst cluelessness. I mean, so it's a range between clueless and delusional. I'm not sure. But no, at worst, by a self-sacrificial commitment to anybody who claims suffering in the world. Right. That's the worst. And the best is that we're just clueless and delusional. But that's the range, right? Between explicit self-sacrifice, which to a large extent I think dominated Bush and Obama, to some people in the administration just being clueless and delusional, bringing democracy to Iraq, bringing freedom to the Libyans, having no idea about the culture that is involved there. Okay, so point one, why are we even there? What is even going on there? Who are the good guys? Who are the bad guys? We have no clue, and we're sending people into that harm's way. Second, and this is just, and the second is just a simple administrative failure, if you will, right? Not taking into account the risks involved. Again, being so detached from the reality of what's going on the ground as to send basically an ambassador with two bodyguards into Benghazi on the anniversary of 9/11 without any consideration to the risk that they face. Now, that should have involved people being fired in the State Department at the very least. And I don't know if it goes up to the Secretary of State, which was Hillary Clinton at the time, but somebody should have been fired for putting this ambassador at risk in the way that they did. It's not that the people on the ground didn't know the risks. They knew the risks. Although there's some indication that the guy who ran the CIA, the CIA group there was also kind of just interested in his career, had no real sense of what was going on in the place, and again, delusional. But somebody should have lost their job. Somebody should have been fired. And this goes to the point that in government, people never suffer the consequences of their bad actions. This is a massive failure when an American ambassador dies and when it could have been prevented, when nobody knows why he's there, but even if he's there, he doesn't get the security that he needs. So, you know, what we don't hold our politicians accountable at all. We don't hold our bureaucrats accountable at all for none of this. Nobody was held accountable. Nobody suffered the consequences. Right. So, and now, granted, I'm using a movie and a little bit of knowledge about the situation and a lot of knowledge about the Middle East to make an assessment, and it's dangerous because movies are movies. They're not truth. But I really don't think anything I've said so far is far from the truth, and indeed the truth is probably, most likely, a lot worse than this. Right. Now, you know, somebody's pointing out that Stephen was probably supposed to be taken hostage by the Libyans. It doesn't matter. The point is you put them in harm's way. By the way, according to the movie, they burn the house down where he is trapped, and they know exactly what he's doing, and he dies of suffocation. He dies in the house that's being burnt down. So it could be that they were just incompetent and they killed him instead of taking him hostage. But it doesn't matter. The point is somebody in the American government put this guy and the people surrounding him in harm's way. They should have known better, no question about that. And yet there are no consequences. By the way, after the attack on the so-called embassy, on the consulate, on the place where the ambassador was, the Libyans then turned around and attacked the CIA base, which was not so secret, and everybody pretty much knew where it was. And they attacked that. And so here's an attack going on, and it goes on for hours, right? It's basically these six Americans. They're the only real combat experienced people on this base. They killed dozens of Libyans, maybe 100. I don't know. I've seen various numbers in the movie. Two of them die, but it's those six defending the entire place. It's a pretty big compound. And amazing acts of heroism, amazing ability as soldiers to do what they're supposed to do. And no help comes. No help comes. There are airplanes based in Italy. Probably, I'm guessing a little bit, but half an hour's flight away. They could have come. They could have flattened all the buildings surrounding the CIA base. But they didn't. Why? Collateral damage. We don't want to piss off the Libyans. You don't want to piss off the Libyans. Give me a break. The job of the U.S. government and the job of the U.S. military is to protect Americans. If the Libyans are attacking, you do what is necessary to protect your people, the Libyans. Yeah, there would have been casualties. There would have been civilian casualties. But no, God forbid we do that. Let them kill. Because if the Libyans would have gotten into that compound, they might have killed or at least taken hostage all of those CIA operatives. 26, 30 Americans would have been taken hostage. So, I mean, imagine that scenario. Would anybody in the upper echelons of the U.S. government done anything? Now, the CIA guy there, the head of the station, keeps telling them to stand down in a sense. Nothing's going to happen. Everything's going to be fine. Although once the shooting starts, he recognizes that they have no choice but to defend the host place. Right? It's, you know, it is just no air support. And it's not that you had to fly from the U.S. and it's ours. We have NATO planes stationed in Italy that did a lot of bombing of Libya in order to – see, this is the thing. You can have collateral damage if the purpose is to help the Libyans get rid of Gaddafi. God forbid you have collateral damage to protect Americans. That's the altruism. That is the self-sacrifice behind all of our foreign policy. That is the altruism. I want to emphasize this because this is true of Bush. This is true of Obama. This is true of Hillary Clinton. And this is, in a sense, what Donald Trump is capitalizing on. Although, again, I don't think his foreign policy would be any different. But this is what he's capitalizing on. This is the sacrifice. This is the... the idea that if we're going to go to war, it has to be beneficial to the people we're fighting, not, God forbid, to us. That would be selfish. That would be arrogant. That would be too much in America's self-interest. And that's never a reason. So here you get no air support. Now, there are troops you could have brought in. Again, via air. They could have paratrooped it. You could have landed helicopters. The six fleets, as far as I know, is in the Mediterranean. The idea that there was no way to get these people help, bizarre and ridiculous, and it just shows again that the American military at the upper echelons, the American politicians, the American government, and at the end of the day, the American people don't care about our troops, don't care about our soldiers, and we don't care about the people we send into harm's way, supposedly to defend ourselves. And that's horrific because, again, nobody paid a consequence. Nobody cares about Benghazi. A few Republicans investigated and showed that Hillary Clinton lied, but nobody cares. Nobody cares. This isn't going to be an issue. Maybe Trump will make it a big issue, but I don't think it'll work because I don't think anybody cares. So, right, so we've got the question of why are we even there? We shouldn't be there. Why do we have an embassy? Why do we have a big CIA station? I understand having CIA agents, covert agents, but having a big station is a pretext. We're pretending our allies and these are friends. And then, I mean, go back. Why did we even depose Gaddafi? Why was that any of our business? Why did we even intervene? Why were American jets involved? If the Europeans wanted to do this and the French were very involved, let them do it. Why did we even have to come over there? Had nothing to do with us. And destabilized the whole place and brought about the mess that exists there today, where it's a training ground for ISIS. All right, so here we are. Now, what else comes across in the movie? So no help. Now, in the movie, there is a hint that in America, the whole attack on the CIA bases and on the ambassador, that in America, they are saying that it was caused by a video on YouTube. There were demonstrations that turned it to violence. And the guys there are saying, what demonstrations? We didn't see any demonstrations. There were no demonstrations. And then they say later, this was planned. There's no way they could have done it unless this was carefully planned. And all the evidence since the attack supports this idea. It wasn't the video. It was a carefully planned attack targeting Americans on the anniversary of 9/11. Hillary Clinton lied, and the fact she lied is just one more thing against her. Again, her foreign policy is much more of against her. It's much worse than the fact that she lied. But she lied. She pays no consequence. No consequence for the fact that she lied. And, you know, this lie was perpetuated for days before they acknowledged the truth. And this is something I've commented on previous shows. And as part of that lie, they tried to take the video off of YouTube and went after Google in an attempt to silence free speech, which is maybe the most horrific thing coming out of this whole thing that I can imagine, because the federal government, the U.S. government, called up Google and told them to take a video off. All right. So one more thing that comes across in the movie, and this is why I liked the movie, even though it made me incredibly angry, is because it had a lot of content. It had a lot of stuff that we can talk about. So the movie shows the kind of absurd, self-sacrificial, suicidal rules of engagement that our troops have to function under. There are a number of scenes in the movie where they are not, where they are being attacked, and the commander tells them, don't shoot until you see a gun. Don't shoot until you see. They know they're under attack. They know they're going to be fired on. There's no question. It's 100%. But until they see a gun, and he says at some point, I don't want you going to jail. So it's not that he's concerned about shooting civilians, because he knows right then and there that they're not civilians. He's concerned about what happens when they get home and Americans prosecute them and put them in jail for violating the rules of engagement. I mean, can you imagine that? Can you imagine the betrayal that is involved in sending troops into battle without the ability to shoot when they think they are being threatened? Without, and where they have to see a gun, or they have to know this is clearly their life is at risk, even though they are sure, they are convinced, but they have to be able to prove it to a jury in the United States of America who wasn't there. I mean, that is treasonous to send troops into those kind of conditions. And in several parts of the movie, because they don't fire, they take casualties. Because they don't fire, the enemy manages to kill some of them. So frustrating. And the idea that the woman who was in charge of, you know, the idea that the woman who was in charge of the State Department at the time is now has a good chance of becoming the next president of the United States is just horrific. And yet, this is where we are, and this is what is quite likely to happen. Of course, the president of the United States, who should ultimately be responsible for all of this, there were no negative consequences to him. There were no negative consequences to the generals who did not send the Air Force in. There were no consequences to generals who did not reinforce the troops. There were no consequences to the CIA leadership who placed all those people in danger in Libya. Just no consequences to anyone involved. All right. So it's depressing. I encourage you to watch the movie because the six Americans who fight this out are quite impressive, and they're real heroic in spite of the ridiculous circumstances in which they're being placed, in spite of the ridiculous attitude of the U.S. government and the lack of support that they get. It's well acted. It's well done. It's a well done movie. It's not a great movie, but it's a well done movie, and I recommend it. So I start today's show with a movie recommendation instead of ending it. But I thought this was very relevant to the Democratic convention, given that Hillary is the nominee, and Hillary was responsible, as the person in charge of the State Department, for much of what happened here. And then nothing was done. Nobody paid the consequences, and nobody, it seems, will. So here we have the disaster that is this year's election. You've got Trump and you've got Hillary. All right, we're going to take a short break, and then I see I've got some callers, so we'll take some calls on the line. And then we'll see about any other topics we get to. So we're going to take a short break.
With adoring fans, rabid critics, and very few in between, why does Atlas Shrugged evoke such impassioned responses? Because it grapples with the fundamental problems of human existence, and it presents radically new answers. Atlas Shrugged challenges many conventional notions about good and evil, that sex is a low animal desire, that money is the root of evil, that man is sinful by nature. One of the most prominent is the notion that selfishness is evil and self-sacrifice is good. Atlas Shrugged is a dramatization of Ayn Rand's unique vision of existence and of man's highest potential. 12 years in the writing, it is her masterwork. Rand's worldview emerges in the plot turns of this compelling mystery, centered on one question: who is John Galt? There are many legends. Which of these is true? Is he the man who discovered the Fountain of Youth? The man who found the lost city of Atlantis? A modern Prometheus? Does he even exist? And why, if no one knows the answer, does the entire world know his name? Find out the answer when you read the novel that sparked a philosophical revolution. Order it today on Amazon.com.
The Ayn Rand Institute campus is an exciting online destination offering free e-courses on Ayn Rand and her revolutionary philosophy of objectivism. Whether you recently picked up your first Rand book or have been reading her novels and nonfiction for years, ARI Campus has something for you. On campus, you'll discover a variety of multimedia courses covering Rand's literary classics, specific aspects of thought, and how to apply her ideas to your life. Get started today at campus.aynrand.org. See you on campus.
In 1934, Ayn Rand wrote to journalist and essayist H.L. Mencken, "Perhaps it may seem a lost cause at present, and there are those who will say that I am too late, that I can only hope to be the last fighter for a mode of thinking which has no place in the future. But I do not think so. I intend to be the first one in a new battle, which the world needs as it has never needed before, the first to answer the many too many advocates of collectivism and answer them in a manner which will not be forgotten." Every day at ARI, we work to make sure that Ayn Rand's answer will not be forgotten. Help us. Contribute today at AynRand.org/support.
The Ayn Rand Institute's mission is to promote Ayn Rand's philosophy of reason, rational self-interest, and laissez-faire capitalism. We are currently looking for talented, passionate, and bright people who share our goal of advancing Ayn Rand's ideas in the world. The Ayn Rand Institute offers you the opportunity to impact the culture and make a difference each and every day. If you're interested in working at the Ayn Rand Institute, visit us at aynrand.org today. There you'll find details on employment opportunities and how to apply.
The critics of income inequality say they are for social justice. But what does that mean? It means that if you are really productive, if you work hard, create a lot of wealth, and make a lot of money, you're doing something bad. You're creating inequality. So what's fair? Well, some say what's fair is to have the government take a bunch of your money and give it to other people. Why do these people deserve to be given money from others? The answer is because they didn't create much wealth. That's what it all comes down to. Social justice says we should punish people who have done nothing wrong for the sake of people who have not been wronged. On the other hand, justice says we should only punish people for the wrong they've done to others. For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality, out in bookstores everywhere on March 29th. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
All right, so we're back. This is the Yaron Brook Show, and we're talking, we just talked about 13 Hours, the movie, and what it means for American foreign policy and what it means in terms of judging Hillary and judging just generally our government and its foreign policy. Let me remind you that I thought that George Bush's foreign policy was treasonous and that, in a sense, Obama is just continuing that policy just from a position of even greater weakness, and that Hillary, I suspect, will govern somewhat closer to Bush on foreign policy. Less weakness than Obama, but still the same self-sacrificial policies. Okay, we got a couple of calls here, so let's take this first call. Hi, you're on the Yaron Brook Show. Who's this?
Hi, this is Jennifer, Michigan.
Hey, Jennifer, how are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm good.
This is now that we have a woman nominee. It reminded me about when I was like a teenager. I remember Ayn Rand's article about a woman president. And that she wouldn't want to vote for one, not because a woman couldn't do it, but she was thinking a woman psychologically shouldn't want that job.
Yep.
And I remember at the time I agreed with it because I guess I have that same psychology, so I thought, well, that makes sense, you know. But now that I'm older, I was thinking, well, maybe if a woman had a different psychology, maybe that would be okay. But I was just wondering, I just recently became familiar with you, and I don't know what you think about that.
Yep. Yeah, well, let me put it this way. First, it's not philosophy. So Ayn Rand's idea about whether a woman should be president or not is a psychological and a very subtle point that she makes about what it means to be feminine and what femininity means, and that a woman, true to her nature, as Ayn Rand understood it, would not want to be president, and therefore Ayn Rand couldn't really trust a woman or couldn't really get behind a woman who wanted to be president because she wasn't being true to her nature in some fundamental sense. Now, that's a point in psychology, not in philosophy. So, and I'm not very, you know, I'm not very knowledgeable about psychology. So I'm not an expert. And I worry about commenting on this at all, because whatever I say is going to be tweeted and blogged about and so on. And all these caveats about me not being a psychologist won't apply. I mean, my view is this. To a large extent, I agree with Ayn Rand in terms of the psychological point about what femininity means and what masculinity means. So I think those are right. But on the question of presidency, I think from a voter's perspective, my perspective is I just want the best candidate who could do the best job. And I don't care if that's a woman or a man. I don't care about their sexual orientation. I don't care about a lot of the psychological issues that Ayn Rand might have raised because we're so desperate for somebody good in the job. And I really do think that in spite of the psychology, some people – I'm really going to get into trouble. my suspicion is that in the sense of femininity that Ayn Rand understood it, some women are less feminine in that sense. and some women are more masculine in the sense of Ayn Rand understood it. And that's okay. I don't have a problem with that. And if a woman wants to assert herself, is like, you know, is like that, I I'm all for that, and I have no problem. I don't have a problem with a woman being president at all, in spite of the fact that in a significant respect, I agree with her characterization of femininity and masculinity. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's what I thought. Yeah, that's what I thought too, because I personally think like her. I'm that kind of femininity, so that's why at the time, as a young girl, I thought, well, yeah, I wouldn't want to do that either. But then when I got older, I thought, well, if you're different from that, I guess that would be okay. Yep. It wouldn't be immoral or anything. It's just different. So.
No, and I don't think she would say it was immoral. I don't think she would have said it was immoral. And she doesn't in that article.
No. Yeah. I mean, there's some variations that you can have on these types of things that are still okay.
Yes, I agree. So. I agree completely with that. So, and as a consequence, I wouldn't have, you know, I don't support that particular position Ayn Rand had on a woman being president. I don't want Hillary to be president, not because she's a woman.
No.
For lots
of
other
reasons. If there was a woman and a man and like they were both equal, I would pick the man just because I'm a woman, but that's another subject.
Yeah.
You know
but
what
if
I mean?
The woman was better, I would definitely pick the woman.
Well, yeah, if it was better, but if they were the same, but that's not going to happen. So.
Yeah, that's a hard one because nobody's ever the same.
No.
Great.
Okay,
well I really
much.
Appreciate the call. Sure. Thanks for calling.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, let's take one other call. This is from 808 area code. Hi, this is you're on Brooke Show.
Aloha, it's Stuart.
Hey, Stuart, how's it going? I should have known. Who else is calling from Hawaii?
Yeah. May I ask a non-political question?
Sure.
Because I remember you tweeted, cause I guess people do study your tweets all the time, but you said that politics is not primary. People should remember that. If we want to change the political system, we have to change the culture first and get people excited about reason. And I want to ask you about how can we get young people excited about reason, because I'm really worried about this front, because anytime I'm with young people and I say, oh, I'm for a reason, they say, oh, you're part of the skeptic movement along with James Randi, so you don't believe in Bigfoot and UFOs. And you don't like health scams. They think reason is limited to that. And then when I say, no, you can also apply this to, you know, ethics. You can get ought from is with life as a standard of value. And suddenly they just roll their eyes at me. You know.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I mean, this is off topic, but let me say a few words on it. And we can talk about this more in a future show where we're dedicated more to this. But. I think the best way to get young kids to respect reason is to teach them science and math. And I think we do such an injustice to these kids by not insisting they get a good math and science education. Everybody, whether they're going to be a scientist, an engineer, or if they're going to be, or if they're going to work in McDonald's, they need to learn basic science and math, and as much science as math as we can stick into the curriculum. So do away with all the social sciences. I mean, other than they should learn history, they should learn English, math, and science. That's pretty much it. I mean, writing and reading, of course, but that's it. And they should learn that throughout their schooling, and they should get this notion that, wow, science is exciting and science is interesting and science is the way we learn to know about the world. This is how we discover things. And then they will induce from that, they will extrapolate from that, that why should we stop learning about the world using science or the methodology of reason when we go into other aspects of our life. So you don't even have to teach them that explicitly. But if you teach them the science as well, and of course, if you teach them history well and they start to see cause and effect in history, then they will get the efficacy of reason. Now, if you're coming into the current educational system where they have no respect for reason, where it hasn't been taught, and you're trying to convince them of it, it's really, really difficult. And yeah, you're right. The skeptics don't help because they claim to be pro-science, but then they're also really skeptical about lots of things. And the essential characteristic they believe of science is to be skeptical, whereas for us, the essential characteristic of science is to use reason, is to be rational, is to evaluate facts. It's to so you just have to talk to them about what we part of the issue is. You can't go in and say, I believe in reason, because they have no conception of what that means. You have to go in and explain what reason is. You have to go in and talk about facts. You have to go in and talk about proof. You have to go in and talk about non-contradiction. You have to go in and talk about logic, very basic things that they don't know. And unless you establish the basic thinking methodology, it doesn't matter what you tell them. It's going to be wasted on them. Does that make sense?
Well, you know that. Well, yeah, but I mean, that makes me worried because, you know,
you should be worried.
I got involved in the GMO debate. I met, you know, I started talking with lots of scientists, and they were very much for the free market when it came to something they knew about with GMOs, but they are statists on everything else. They sound exactly like Dr.
Yeah,
Robert Stadler, where they
again,
think in a free market.
But again, I'm not advocating for scientists, and we shouldn't be pro-scientists. And it's not enough to learn science, but I'm talking about kids. If you go into – kids have to learn the methodology of thinking, and the best way to learn the methodology of thinking is through science and through math. And if they learn the methodology to think, then we have a chance at convincing them about free markets. But if you start with no idea of what reason is and how to think, then forget about convincing anybody about free markets. And this is why,
oh,
in some respects, we have more chance with the left than we do with the right. Because the left, at least, has respect, at least they claim to have respect, for science and reason. The right, by dismissing science and reason, there's nothing to talk about. There's no hope.
Well, I think their philosophy of science, you know, needs a lot of reform because when I read books written for children about science,
sure,
they agree with,
sure,
Karl Popper about how, you know, no theory is ever conclusively,
yep,
proven. They can only be,
yep,
disproven. We
but
only
that,
have
but that's right.
Model
so,
yet to be disproven.
That's right. So you need a proper philosophy of science. But even if you just teach the kids science, forget about the philosophy of science, just science, just proper understanding of science and its value in the world, we will be far better off. But if you're going to get to reason, that's the way to get to reason. And Karl Popper, unfortunately, dominates the philosophy of science today, following on Hume. And that needs to be defeated. That needs to be challenged. And that's what objectivist philosophers, one of the things they need to be focused on. All right. Thanks, Stuart. Really appreciate the call. And let's,
mahalo.
We've got one other one. Let's see. Yep. Whoops. No, disappeared. Okay, disappeared. Somebody was calling from 847, I think, area code, and got dropped off. So if you still want to ask a question, call back. And if any of you want to ask a question, 347-324-3075, 347-324-3075. So there we go. So the 847 person is back. Hi, you're on the Yaron Book Show. Who's this?
Hi, Yaron. It's Jonathan Honig.
Hey, Jonathan. How are you?
Just wanted to thank you for your wonderful show. Quick question.
Sure.
I know you're not a psychologist, but do you think there's a difference in people who lie about big things versus small things?
Wow, interesting question.
As you were talking before about Hillary.
Yeah.
Quickly,
yeah.
I know you want to talk too much about politics, but it seems like,
yeah,
Hillary's lies are often about big, important things. Benghazi emails.
Yeah.
Trump's lies often seem about inconsequential small things like,
yep,
crowd sizes or his wife's speech. So
yep,
what would you say about the difference between people who evade on different types of things like that?
Well, I mean, I haven't really thought about it, but you know, I think they have very different psychologies. I think that Hillary Clinton is a power luster who will lie to get the job. She will do whatever she can to get the job. And that's why you see it as lies on big things, because to get the job, she has to lie on big things. But she also lies on little things, because she clearly lies to herself, or at least the people around her, about Bill Clinton's behavior, about all his mistresses, about all of that. So there's a lot of lying going on. But the key motivation for the lying is, I want to get power and I want to hold on to it. And that's what motivates her. psychologically, I think. Trump has, in my view, and I'm going to get crucified for this, has like a really, really low self-esteem. And his primary motivation is to get people to like him and to love him, to please people in some way, right? To get their applause, to get their... So anything that that threatens the facade that he has created, right, of the greatest person on the planet, that's going to create the greatest country in the world, that's just great in every aspect, is a threat to his self-esteem. So he has to lie constantly about little things, because every little thing is a threat to his self-esteem. Now, he's going to have to lie about big things, because they're going to be a threat to his self-esteem as well. But the motivation is different. Now, he wants power as well, but he wants power to compensate for this lack of self-esteem, and he thinks that through power, he will gain love. He will gain the adoration of the masses. But, you know, every time he's asked about what really motivates him, it comes down to, I want people to like me. I want high poll numbers. This is why the polls are so important to him. Everything that's important to him is the size of the audience, the amount of clapping he gets. So he's motivated by this emptiness inside of him. Now they're both empty, I know, but to him it's a real self-esteem issue. It's very personal. And that's why anytime he's attacked, he's got the thinnest skin I've ever seen in politics or anywhere. He like lashes out immediately because he has zero self-esteem. It's quite astounding to watch. Does that correspond with your thinking?
I think that's very perceptive, and I'll quickly just recommend from before. Obviously,
Jonathan, I'm losing you. Can you try again and repeat again? Because I lost you there.
Sure. I'm sorry. Is this a little better? I'll let you go, your own.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Your phone connection is just not a good connection. But I'd love to hear what you think. So at some point, get a better phone connection and let me know. All right. So let's get back to Hillary. And I know Stuart brought this up, that I said on Twitter, politics is not the most important thing. And it is not. I want to emphasize that. Think about our discussions here on politics as a means to get to more important issues. One, hopefully methodologically, what I try to do on the show is to analyze these candidates and analyze these events using reason, so that we're modeling the right way to think about these issues, which is much more important than the actual conclusion that you get to. Right. So we want to model reason. Secondly, when I talk about 13 hours, the most important point about there is what we learn about American foreign policy, the idea of self-sacrifice, the idea of altruism, the moral ideas that are driving everything, right? And those are what are significant. Those are what are important. It's actual politics. At the end of the day, what I think about Donald Trump, about Hillary Clinton, makes very little difference. The 5,000 people listening to this show are unlikely to be the difference in the election, even if you all were just my puppets and did exactly what I told you, which you're not. You have your own minds and you choose yours. So if I endorse a candidate, it makes no impact on this election. So the election itself doesn't matter. Either one of these candidates is going to be awful. They're going to be horrible. They're going to be a massive, unequivocal disaster. And those of you who think otherwise are just delusional, in my view. Right? You should never attack your listeners, but what the hell? If you think Trump is different, that Trump is better, that Trump is great, in my view, you are delusional, completely delusional. And the fact that Trump wants to win is meaningless, because Trump has no concept of what winning is. You know, that Muslim father who stood up there at the Democratic National Convention, and we'll talk about the Democratic National Convention now, stood up and shook the Constitution in Donald Trump's face and said, "You should read this," is absolutely right. Donald Trump needs to read that so he knows what winning even means. but he has no concept of the Constitution and has never, as far as I can tell, suddenly if he's read it, he doesn't understand it or he doesn't believe he should be promoting it because he never talks about it. So let's talk about the convention, the Democratic convention, and it really looks like that's all I'm going to be able to talk about today. We'll see what we can do. I'll talk about some of these other issues on my Chicago show, shift them to there, maybe we'll see what we can get to beyond the convention here. All right. Convention. So I didn't watch much of it. I read about it. I read some of the speeches. I read Hillary's speech. And I did watch the first day of the convention because I was stuck at an airport in, I think it was Dallas, on my way to New York and got stuck in the airport, and it was showing on the TV. So I watched it. And I watched Cory Booker's talk, and I watched Michelle Obama's speeches at the convention. And I thought, put aside ideas for a second, I thought they both gave excellent speeches. I thought they were really good. They were poised. They were engaging. They were passionate, and much better than what I saw on the Republican side in terms of just how you give a speech and how you engage with an audience. I mean, Cory Booker had a tough job because at that point in the convention, the Bernie Sanders fans were making a huge big deal, and they were interrupting everybody. They were, they make a big deal about the treatment Bernie Sanders had gotten. And so he couldn't get a word in edgewise. And Cory Booker got up and in spite of that, managed to silence the Bernie Sanders fans and actually get everybody cheering what he had to say. Now, what he had to say was pretty conventional Democratic BS, but he did it very, very well. And he managed to spin it in what is a positive message. And generally, I would say this, and this is such a tragedy. What you notice throughout the Democratic convention is that they try to be positive. They try to portray solutions. They try to say that America wasn't all washed up, that indeed it was doing pretty well and could do much better. And they had ideas about that. They were positive, engaged. I thought that throughout the convention, you saw them citing the founding fathers. Now, partially that's because they were in Philadelphia, but they were the Democratic Party suddenly is the party of the founding fathers. I mean, there's a shocker for you. They were embracing the founders. They were embracing the Declaration of Independence, or the Cory Booker called it the Declaration of Interdependence, which I guess he stole from FDR. But, you know, the parties kind of switch roles. I mean, the Democratic Party looked much more like the party of Reagan, and the Republican Party looked much more like the party Jimmy Carter. Well, not really. Jimmy Carter in the sense of giving up. Jimmy Carter in the sense of everything's bad, everything's terrible, everything's falling apart, there's no out. But with a heavy, heavy dose of anger and frustration and meanness and yelling. I mean, the number one, tip that all the Republican speakers, with exception maybe of Donald Trump's family members, got in terms of inspiring people was to yell. I mean, Giuliani was just yelling. Gingrich was just yelling. And to put the fear of God into people, the Democratic convention was better run than the Republican Party. The speeches that were supposed to be in primetime were actually in primetime. And it was just a better balance and a more interesting convention. Now, they pandered to Bernie Sanders. They pandered to his constituency. This was the most statist Democratic Party you will ever see on economic policy. And, you know, in foreign policy, they were Bush light, but on domestic policy, they were Bernie Sanders. They tried to emulate Bernie Sanders. They blamed everything They followed Bernie Sanders and blaming everything on the millionaires and billionaires. But they did it in a way of inspiring some hope in the future. So Cory Booker was definitely motivational. Wrong, but motivational. Even Michelle Obama, I thought, was quite good in having the right tone. Her presentation skills are excellent. She's going to run for president, I suspect. I think the election in like 8 years or 12 years is going to be Michelle Obama versus Chelsea Clinton, right? I think Chelsea will be old enough. So maybe 12 years. Michelle Obama versus Chelsea Clinton. How are you going to vote on that one? Actually, those are two Democrats. I'm not sure who would run on the Republican side at that point. So to be a three-way race on the Democratic side between Michelle Obama, Chelsea Clinton, and Ivanka Trump, right? Because Ivanka is hugely Democratic in her speech in the Republican convention. I mean, she could have been speaking at the Democratic convention. There was nothing right in any sense. But this is part of the issue. That there's no sense anymore in which there's a big difference between the two parties, other than the Democrats are more hysterically anti-wealth than Republicans are. And the Republicans are more nativists than the Democrats are. But in many other respects, the differences are small in terms of how they govern. But even in terms of what was said during the conventions, other than the immigration and the over and over again, make America great again. And I think the Democrats did if you value reason over fear and emotion, one could argue that the Democrats had a much better convention than the Republicans did. They were calmer. They were more reasonable in their arguments. Again, all wrong. I'm not. Don't get me wrong. And fear mongering and hate mongering against wealth and against the wealth creators, but in a much more subdued, much more reasonable way and tone. And tone matters. Now it turns out that the Americans don't want subdued. They don't want positive. They don't want solutions. What they want is somebody to stand up and say, I will solve all your problems. And you have a lot of them. And most of those problems, by the way, caused by you, they were caused by other people. And I will hit those other people. I will crush those other people for you. And that's my solution to all your problems. I mean, that's the kind of superficiality that obviously the American people are responding to and are interested in. All right, so I thought the speeches, the first night, were good speeches, qua speeches. Again, the same kind of thing, the same kind of America, playing to the racism card. But at least not like Trump. The end of the world is coming because crime rates are through the roof. Crime rates are at some of the lowest they've been in American history. But they played the racism card. They played this many socialist cards. Free education, that was huge, right? Everywhere. They took that from Bernie. Free education. We're going to give free education to everything. How are you going to pay for it? No answer. We're going to take it from the hedge fund managers. I think Hillary said that. We're going to take it from the hedge fund managers. They're finally going to pay their fair share. The millionaires and billionaires, that's who we're going to get the money from. Of course, if you run the math, none of that is possible. But they played the redistribution. We're going to take care of you, our constituency, and their constituency is not angry people. Their constituency is young people. And young people, and this is the difference again between the parties, young people are much more inclined to be positive, energetic, optimistic, angry about certain things, but not angry as an end state, right? So the Democrats, they're angry about student loans, so we'll forgive you the student loans. You're angry about high tuition, so we'll forgive you the high tuition. You're angry about expensive health care, so we'll give you free health care. All right. Now, let me just say about crime again, because it's coming up on the chat here, and I'm sure it's in your minds. crime rates at the lowest they've ever been, even the killing of police. Now, granted, we've seen a number of very high-profile ones, and we seem to be very – every time a policeman is killed now, it makes the top of the news. Now, I'm not trying to belittle this. This is a real problem and an ugly problem and a horrific problem, particularly – manifest in Dallas and Baton Rouge, where they were targeted execution style, and they were killed because of their policemen. Again, if you look at the statistics, policemen were killed at a much, much, much higher rate in the 1970s. They were killed at a much, much higher rate in the late 1980s. The highest rate for police killings in American history was during Prohibition in the 1920s and early 30s. So relative to those periods, we're still at the low rate of police getting killed. And that's consistent with the general decline over the last 20, 30 years in violence. And even if you include terrorism, if you include the number of people killed in terrorist activities, it's very small relative to the decline in violence. Right now, if you look at Europe right now, because there's a lot of hysteria, if you look at Nice, Paris, Charlie Hebdo, all the other killings in Germany now, and you compare all of that to killings during the PLO Red Brigade era of the 1960s and 70s, killings are still significantly lower on a per annum basis in Europe than they were back then. Even since Obama's presidency, crime rates have declined, except for last year, which was a slight increase. But this is noisy. You're going to get ups and downs. But generally, the trend, and there's no indication that this year is going to deviate from that trend, crime rates are down, including on Obama's presidency. Shooting of police are up this year, but they're up off of a low, very, very low rate, which was last year and all the years previous. Crime, all violent crime, rape, assault, all violent crime rates are down since they peaked in the early 90s. And why that is I haven't heard a convincing answer. There are a lot of different explanations, but the empirical fact is unquestionable, right? And of course, we shouldn't let them get higher, but there's no indication that systematically they're getting higher. There's every indication that the continued trend is downwards, with the exception of some cities. Now, could they be even lower? Absolutely. And we should do whatever we can to make them even lower. And certainly, you know, if what you care about crime, and this is part of the problem I think some conservatives have, if you care about crime, then certainly crime is much lower in Europe, even including terrorism. Crime, violence against, you know, ordinary citizens is much, much lower in Europe, but we don't want to become Europe. So, you know, for a variety of reasons. And so you have to look at Europe. What makes Europe different? And there are lots of things that make Europe different to make crime rates in Europe much lower than they are in the United States. So, but again, I think it's really, really important for us, for me, as an advocate for Ayn Rand, because I don't know if you guys are, as an objectivist, to have objectivity, which means to base one's decisions on facts. On facts. And the hysteria about crime right now is counterfactual. It's counterfactual. What Trump said in his speech was hysteria, was fear-mongering, was anger, and it was counterfactual. And you know, I agree the country's going in the wrong direction. Things are really bad, but not for those reasons, not for the reasons described, not for the reasons described. So, you know, we got to stick to facts as objectivists. We've got to stick to reason and analyze things reasonably. Anyway, the Democratic Convention, to sum up, was horrific. It was horrific because it was a good convention. It was horrific because they tend to be positive. It was horrific because their ideas of how to make America better in the future are unbelievably dangerous and bad. unbelievably dangerous and bad. So, you know, there's no bright spot here. Democrats are awful. The Republicans are awful. You guys are going to have to decide who to vote for. I'm not going to tell you who to do that. But it's bad, bad. We're in bad, bad shape. I mean, Hillary's speech was exactly what you'd expect. The combination of, you know, pandering to the American people, a litany of the things she's going to do for us, the way she's going to save us. At least she gives specifics or somewhat specifics, all pandering primarily to Bernie Sanders when it comes to economic issues. And then on foreign policy, she's just Obama. She's a Bush light, Obama light, however you want to call it. She's somewhere between the two. Somebody's asking again about Obama's racial divisiveness and terrorism. I mean, I've talked about racism before, so I'll just say this. Racism, I think, is getting worse in America, and I think the reasons for that are historical. They have to do with affirmative action and the way we have dealt with race. The fact that white America has not been willing to acknowledge fully the extent of the racism that existed in this country in the pre-civil rights era, and the extent of that racism and the horrific nature of that racism. And then to try to appease their own guilt, they accepted affirmative action, which is reverse racism. You can't fix racism with racism. So what we've done, I don't think it's Obama's fault. I think Obama makes it worse, but I don't think it's Obama's capitalizing on 50 years of a lack of acknowledgement on the one side of the extent and the seriousness. And I'm talking on the kind of, if you will, quote, Republican side, on the right. There's no acknowledgement. I think flying the Confederate flag is the perfect symbol of that. You cannot fly the Confederate flag and have acknowledged the evil of racism fully and the fact that it existed so recently in American society. And the fact of affirmative action, that combination is a very bad combination. And President Obama has made a bad situation worse. And I don't think Obama is any different with regard to terrorism than Bush was. Go read what I've written about terrorism. They're both awful. They're both horrific. Obama's just Bush weak, a weak Bush. But Bush was already pathetic and awful and horrible. Anyway, let's we're in bad shape. We're in bad shape politically. Okay, I'm going to take another call. Hi, you're on the Yaron Brooks Show. Who's this? Go ahead, area code 207.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
This is Nick.
Hey, Nick, Maine. How are you? From Maine.
Hi,
cool.
Yeah. I was actually wondering.
Yep.
Don't you think that the optimism in the Democratic Convention, wouldn't that somewhat be in part because they're the incumbent party?
Yeah, yeah.
So they can't really say much that implies that anything was going wrong in America.
I think you're right. I think it's for the incumbent party, but I think it's more than that. I think they wanted to contrast themselves with Trump. So I think they wanted to contrast themselves with the anger and negativity and darkness of the Trump speech, and I think of the whole Republican convention, which I analyzed last week. So that's the second reason. So incumbent is one, contrast with Trump two. But I think there's an important third reason, and that third reason is they are explicitly trying to appeal to young people and to Bernie Sanders. And if you listen to Bernie Sanders says that there are all these bad things about America, but he says they're fixable and he gives solutions. Now, the solutions are terrible. We know the solutions are terrible. But he's appealing to a go-get-your attitude among young people. We can overcome. There are solutions. If you guys are suffering from tuition, I'm gonna give you free education. And the world's going to be a wonderful place after I give you free education. To real... You know, real areas where young people are really hurting, they're trying to offer real solutions. And so it's not their fault. It's not blaming other people. I mean, except for millionaires and billionaires, but they're part of us. It's offering solutions. Now, again, the solutions are horrible and terrible, but I think it's an attempt to appeal to young people who tend to be less negative. But yeah, there's no question that the issue of incumbency is a big part of that. Do you want to follow that up?
I was also wondering, you were saying that it wasn't that part of the issue with the racial division was that people weren't recognizing what had actually happened in America. Yeah. And with the flying of the Confederate flag, I mean, isn't that more of a that's sort of more a minority section of the Republican Party, isn't it?
Sure, but I think it's symbolic and important. And I mean, I was happy that people like Nikki Haley in South Carolina immediately, you know, was for taking the Confederate flag down. I think that was a good move, and I think the right approach by what you would call mainstream Republicans. But in the past, mainstream Republicans had sanctioned the flying of the Confederate flag, and in doing so, I think rejected this idea. My point is this: there's still a sense of denial, and I meet Americans all the time who deny that racism exists, that kind of don't really know or understand the history of racism in this country and how bad it was. And I think we have to first, before we're going to solve the problem, we have to acknowledge it. And then I think a lot of Americans are angry because of affirmative action, and they're right to be angry because of affirmative action. So I think it's a combination of things, but I don't know that in much of the South, the flying of the Confederate flag is really a minority. I think a lot of people defended it. A lot of people defended it for a long time, and it still flies in some state houses. All right. I really appreciate your call.
Sure.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
We've got one other call, and our time's running out. All right. I'm now getting to no topics that I promised you. All right. You're on the Iran Brooks Show. Who's this?
This is Skylar calling from Delaware, Dr. Brooks.
Hey, Skylar. How's it going?
I'm well, sir. How are you?
I'm good. Depressed, but good.
Understandably. And justifiably so. What would it take for an individual or individuals to actually bring people like George W. Bush and other political leaders up on charges of treason? Could we actually do that? Is there any way we could do it?
No. And if you brought charges of treason against Hillary Clinton, you would have to do the same thing against George W. Bush, because he's responsible ultimately for sending out troops with these rules of engagement and sending them to fight wars with no possibility of victory and advocating for shock and awe and then not doing any shock and awe. So I think Bush is far more culpable than Hillary Clinton is on the issue of treating our soldiers in a treasonous way.
And the rules of engagement as well. How would we be able to repeal them or abolish them?
Well, you should read my article about just war theory. I mean, what we need to do is destroy altruism. They are basically, these are rules that are based on an altruistic philosophy. The philosophy that says that the lives of others are more important than your own life, that the job of the American government is to sacrifice, and the job of American troops is to sacrifice for the sake of others. That can only be repealed once we repeal altruism and not before. And I just don't think it'll happen until we do that. So we've got a long, long fight before us, Skylar. Ain't going to be easy.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yep. Good. Well, thanks for calling. Really appreciate the support. My pleasure.
Yes, sir.
And all right. So let's see. So that's the conventions. Look, I don't want to diminish how bad the Democrats were in terms of their manipulation, in terms of their solutions to problem. But it is striking that, for example, one of the big deals that Hillary made was equal pay for women and time off for women who have babies or pregnancy. And that's exactly the point that Ivanka Trump made in introducing her father, that that was what he was going to do. So on a lot of these things, or some of these things anyway, there is no difference between the political parties. There is no difference between the, at least some parts of the political parties. So, you know, it's hard. It's hard for me to be optimistic when the two candidates, neither of the two candidates running for president of the United States, are qualified or have any idea of what's wrong with America or how to fix it. And again, if I you know, I can be, I'm pretty safe to say nobody out there is a Hillary fan. I mean, there might be some people out there thinking they'll vote for Hillary because they can't vote for Donald Trump, but nobody out there is a Hillary fan. So let me address Trump fans. Trump has no clue as to what are the real problems in America. At least he has not articulated once that I've heard what the real problems are in America or how to fix them. Not a word about it. Not a word about it. So, you know, I can't see how one could be a fan. Right? I don't see how you can be a fan. All right. Let me talk quickly about Brexit. And I think what I'll do is I'm going to take up the Pope on my Chicago radio show, which will you can download from Blog Talk a few days after it airs. Because, hey, Chicago's Catholic, and they should hear what I have to say about the Pope. So let's talk about Brexit, because I think it's fascinating what's happened in the last month about around Brexit. So if you remember, I did a show on Brexit about a month ago when it was first announced. And one of my points was, at the time, the markets collapsed. You know, everybody was envisioning this economic disaster that was imminent. And I find it interesting that a month later, the stock markets of the UK and the US are hitting record highs. So, you know, it turns out that markets don't think Brexit was such an unbelievable, horrific thing. Yeah, the pound has been gone down quite a bit. But if you believe Donald Trump, that's a good thing, right? Because his whole thing about the Chinese manipulating their currency down. Well, I mean, if you're manipulating your currency down is a good thing for Chinese, why isn't it good for Britain? Why isn't it good for America? It's awful for everybody. So it's not good that the pound is cheaper. It's not good for the Brits, but the Brits are really worried about that. And we'll see where the pound lands up later this year. But that reflects some uncertainty. But certainly equity markets seem to be doing fine. The British economy so far, the UK economy so far, is doing fine. And if you look even at the idea that the UK will break up, and again, there was this real panic right after Brexit, and I admit, even I feared that this would be one of the negative consequences of the Brexit vote, would be that all these, you know, Northern Ireland and Scotland would leave the UK in order, in a sense, to join the European Union, or at the very least, because they didn't want to be associated with some aspects of Brexit, basically the nativism. I just read a poll today that the Scots are polling to stay in the UK. That there's been no increase in the desire of the Scots to leave the UK. So I think at the end of the day, kind of reason and people have thought about this and realized that this is not, or doesn't have to be, the disaster that so many predicted it would be. The Conservative Party elected as their next prime minister, the prime minister of England, of the UK right now, a woman who is very much, where did that come from? Oh, I see. Sorry, guys. Whoops. I didn't want to do that either. Let's see. Did I mute that? All right. Sorry about that. I don't know if you heard it. I heard this music in my headphones. So maybe it didn't go to you, but I certainly heard it. All right. So they elected a woman to run it, and it was she's a moderate. She voted against Brexit. which bewilders me why the British people would even tolerate the English people, not the English, not the British, the United Kingdom, the people in the United Kingdom would tolerate this. But she did. She is the prime minister now. And she's very leftist, as far as I can tell, on domestic policy. What is going to, I think, appease the European Union is going to cut a deal where everybody's happy. Nobody's happy or everybody's happy or whatever. And it's going to be interesting. So I think the markets are being calmed. They also realize that this is going to take years to figure out, right? They haven't even triggered Article 50, which is the article that starts the process by which the UK leaves the European Union. So they haven't even triggered that the months before they triggered that. Then once they trigger it, it'll take 2+ years to negotiate a deal. Nothing's going to happen very quickly. It's going to be, you know, there's no big deal here. No big deal, right? So I wouldn't get excited. I wasn't excited about Brexit one way or the other because it's hard to tell what they're going to do. I like the idea of the British taking more control or the UK taking more control of their own fate and the possibility, only a possibility, not a certainty, that they would deregulate, they would lower taxes, that they would actually and create a free trade zone where they had free trade agreements with all the rest of the world. I think that's only a possibility. I hope that becomes a reality. I hope that they are not motivated by Donald Trump's anti-trade nonsense and the nativism that seems to be spreading throughout the world, the xenophobia that Donald Trump and many others all over Europe are embracing. So let's hope that what really comes out of Brexit is free markets. But I just wanted to point out how false the hysteria was, and that usually hysteria is false, particularly when it's quick, fast response to something that's happened. Most of the time, it is overreaction and not based on reality, not based on facts. So, you know, Brexit is going to happen. It's going to happen slowly. It's not going to be as radical as people think. It's being led by a woman who is like on the left side of the conservative movement. She's nowhere near on the right, which is going to make it less interesting and more boring and less good for the UK. So let's hope that the conservatives wake up and kick this woman out and put somebody better in there who would be more radical and more free market oriented. But, you know, that is just a hope. All right. So people complained on the chat that in spite of the fact that the opening was about a movie, it was not positive. It was not positive. So I talked about 13 Hours at the beginning of the show. And while I recommended the movie, it didn't say anything positive about the world. So let's think about a topic that's positive. I can't talk about the Pope because that's really negative. I could talk about this American Indians, but I want more time than the 6 minutes that I have left. So what would be a positive way to leave this show? Okay, let's talk about young people a second, and where I think we have a chance to really get at them and to get to their values and to appeal to reason and to appeal to appeal to the positive values that they hold in order to get them motivated against Bernie and against kind of the ridiculous reliance that they have on the state or their belief in the efficacy of the state. So what are the values that young people have? Or what is one value that young people clearly have today that I think is incredibly important? I think the one value that we can embrace, that we can talk about more, that we can that I think anybody who wants to replace the political system in existence today should talk about more, is the value of technology and the benefits, the enormous, unbelievable benefits that we all gain from technology today. This is something young people love. They love the Uber. They love the Airbnb. They love the iPhones. They love their apps. They love their iTunes or whatever it is they use in order to stream their music, right? They love these things. And they love them for real good reasons. These are positive, rational values. Race, and they love and they respect and they want more of. They love innovation when it affects them in those ways. And yet, they have no clue where it comes from. They have no clue how we get innovation. They have no clue of the role of the mind in creating that innovation. They have no clue, certainly, about the role of freedom in creating that innovation and how you must have freedom in order to be able to sustain that innovation and how in industry after industry, where freedom has gone away, innovation has crumbled. So you can spin this as a positive message. A positive message is about the relative freedom Silicon Valley has, and as a consequence, the great innovations being produced there that are making their lives as young people so much better. And what the potential for innovation is, it's to live an extra 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years of good, healthy life. The biotech industry was freed up. It is the potential of computers to be a million times faster than they are today. And what that means in terms of our abilities to make our lives better, more easier, simpler, and of course, longer and healthier. Yeah, people who love technology seem to be leftists. That's our default. We have screwed up. Silicon Valley is leftist. I blame it on us. The fact that they associate free markets with religion is our fault. Yeah, they're leftists because to the right, what they see is people denying Darwin, denying evolution. That's one of the reasons. There are other reasons they're leftist. So, you know, what we need to do is convince these lovers of technology, these lovers of, you know, the dynamism, the excitement that is Silicon Valley, that freedom is the only thing that will guarantee that that continues. We need to convince them that reason, the same reason they apply in using their devices and creating their devices and innovating, that reason needs to be applied to everything in the world. That skepticism is not what drives science. Reason, logic drives science. And that that same logic and that same reason can be applied to everything else. We need to be admirers of technology. We need to be admirers of science. We need to get rid of the right. We are not on the right. We are not on the left. We are somewhere else in three-dimensional space. We, at least I as an objectivist, you as hopefully interested in objectivism, we are not on the political spectrum. The only way to make our view appealing is to disassociate our view from today's right, from the craziness of today's right, from the craziness of Trump, but also from the craziness of the religious right, for the craziness of the statist right, for the craziness of the xenophobic of what some people are calling now the alt-right, which is the racist right. We need to be distinct from all those groups because we are different. We're not like them in any way. We respect reason. We respect science. We respect individual rights as applied to social and economic issues and political issues. We are different, and we are the only hope this country has, because based on the politics of today down, we need to offer a new vision, a new alternative, and that vision and alternative can start with the great respect and admiration for technology and for the entrepreneurs that create it, and move from there into trying to explain to the American people why that is the essence of Americanism and how we extrapolate from that to everything. All right. You've been listening to Yaron Brooks Show. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you listen every Saturday, 11:30 Pacific time, 2:30 Eastern Time, right here on Blog Talk Radio. You can download it on iTunes. You can download it in any podcasting app. And I'll talk to you next Saturday. And thank you for all the callers. Really appreciate it. And here we go.
For what is a man? What has he got? If not himself, then he's...